The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Bill Woods. Bill is the director of the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, otherwise known as GAO. And Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. Real pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to our conversation today. I've had a lot of interaction in GAO over my career when I was in federal service, and it's an interesting organization, the function, the sort of nexus between the executive branch and the legislative branch. So we're going to talk about all that today. But first, Bill, could you give the listeners a little bit about your background? I understand you have been at GAO for 34 years.
That's correct, Roger. I came to GAO right out of law school. I was trained as a lawyer and started with the government, the General Accounting Office at that time.
Right, I remember that. Yeah.
Still GAO. I started with their Office of General Counsel. My first assignment was to do bid protests, and I did that for about 8 years. That gave me a tremendous amount of training in the acquisition process. I got to see a wide variety of different kinds of procurements and learned an awful lot about the procurement system. Then I moved over to the audit support side of the house, providing legal advice to the evaluators that do the reports that I now oversee. That too was a very, very important and eye-opening part of my professional development. I learned a lot about the procurement system as well, but also how to manage people, what motivates them, what drives them, how they view their careers and what their aspirations are. And that's a very, very important part of the work that we do at the Government Accountability Office today, is deal with people and creating an environment where everybody feels appreciated and feels like they're contributing.
Right. Bill, we're going to talk a lot about the Acquisition Sourcing Management Team and what you guys do there. But first, just I think for the listeners, it would be great to just talk about GAO generally. It's, you know, it's that acronym that everybody hears about, whether it's bid protests or audits on behalf of the Hill or reviews on behalf of the Hill. So first, you know, just in terms of the strategic mission, you know, the oversight role, what does GAO do? Big picture.
Well, our mission, in short, is to support the Congress. We provide analysis. We provide oversight of executive agencies. We provide insight and foresight for the Congress in accomplishing their many roles and objectives. We like to think of ourselves as, and we do think of ourselves as, an independent organization. And it's funny, before I came to GAO, I knew about that much about GAO, that they were an independent entity. Learned that, and everybody learns that, I think, in civics
right, government
classes.
Or whatever. Yeah, yep,
right.
Absolutely.
But I never really knew what that meant. I thought it meant independent from both the executive and the legislative branch of government. We learned early on in my career, there was a Supreme Court case that very clearly told us that we were part of the legislative branch, and that any notion that we were independent of the Congress was simply false, that we were squarely within the legislative branch of the government. We worked for the Congress. That stays with us constantly. We make sure that we work very closely with our congressional clients, that we maintain our independence, though. We do not do the work that the Congress wants us to do. They drive the issues that we look at, but we do not produce results that the Congress dictates by any stretch of the imagination. We are fully independent of our congressional clients. And I'd like to take a minute, if I could, just to talk about the way that we get our work, because I think that your listeners may find that interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are two primary ways that we get our work. First is that Congress will enact statutes that require GAO to review certain programs. Almost any time Congress provides appropriations to the executive branch, they want to make sure that that money is well spent. They conduct their own independent oversight through hearings, et cetera. But they also want an objective, fact-based review of how federal programs are being carried out. And for that, they often turn to the Government Accountability Office. And they do that in two primary ways. One is, as I mentioned, through enacting statutes. They will provide an appropriation or an authorization, typically in the National Defense Authorization Act or similar statutes, that will require the Government Accountability Office to look at how federal programs are being carried out. The second way is through requests. In our organic statute, and I should mention, we've been around since 1921.
That was the 20s.
And in that 1921 statute that created then the General Accounting Office, there was a provision that required us to do work when we got a request from committees of jurisdiction of the Congress. So if we get a letter from the chair of a committee, or if we get a letter from a ranking minority member of a committee of jurisdiction to review a federal program, we will honor that request. So those are the two primary ways that we conduct our work. Probably about 40% of the work through statutory mandates, another 40% through letters from committees of the Congress. And then the remaining 20% we do on what's called the Comptroller General's authority. And that's work that some of your listeners may be familiar with. The most prominent that comes to mind is the high-risk work that we do. We don't do that work by statute. We don't do that work at the request of the Congress. We look at programs that we consider to be of the greatest risk of fraud, waste, and abuse or mismanagement across the federal government. And we started that list back in 1990. That list has grown over time, changed as programs are either added or deleted. But right now there's some 30-odd programs that are on that high-risk list. And that is work that we do not as a result of any request from the Congress, but they sure appreciate that. They want to know where are the programs that the Congress needs to be focusing their oversight attention. That high-risk list helps to focus their attention.
Right. And so, like, for a real life example, that right interagency or government wide contracting was high, on the high risk list for a number. Is that the same list or not?
That is the same list. Right. And you're right. And that I like to think of as an example where the system worked. We, back in the 2003-2004 timeframe, were reviewing the current state of affairs of federal procurement, as we often do. And we noticed that interagency contracting had grown tremendously. But that growth had not been accompanied by sufficient guidance. There were very few provisions in the Federal Acquisition Regulation. There were very few memoranda coming out of the Office of Management and Budget about what agencies should be doing when they conduct interagency contracting. There was not even a good sense of what that really meant. So we decided that because of the lack of guidance and because of the tremendous growth in interagency contracting, that created an element of risk. And in 2005, we placed interagency contracting on our high-risk list. And we outlined what steps we thought agencies needed to take, including the Office of Management and Budget, to address the issues that we identified. Fortunately, the Office of Management and Budget and several other of the large agencies took it very seriously. And within several years, we had seen sufficient progress sufficient enough that allowed us to take that issue off the list.
I was there at that time, and it was a big deal when it was put on the list and the focus that the procurement officials took, particularly at GSA and OMB and DOD as well, to try to address the concerns that were raised. Was a constructive effort. We can talk about maybe a little bit whether the pendulum swung too far on some of this stuff, but that's the way the procurement systems work. But right now, Bill, we do have to take our first break. My guest today is Bill Woods. He is director of the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him what exactly does he do on a daily basis and what his team does. And I also may start by asking him, so that relationship with the executive branch when you're going to review you, is that sort of like, you know, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you? How does that dynamic work? You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf. Today, my guest is Bill Woods. He is the director of the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, otherwise known as GAO, around town. And Bill, when we took the break, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, where your requests come from and the percentages and what you looked at. And we spent a fair amount of time talking about the, you know, the high risk list and interagency contracting in particular. But first, why don't we just step back again and, like, can you talk about the sort of the mechanics of it, like how you get your requests and then how you start executing on it, the operational side, and sort of I'm always interested in that thought too, is when you do knock on the door of an executive agency, how that all plays out. But first start with the Hill and dealing with them and the request and how that all works out.
Sure, Roger. We spend a lot of time with our congressional clients. We want to make sure that we understand their priorities, not the results that they want to achieve, not the agenda that they are wishing to pursue, but the areas that they believe are areas that deserve oversight, programs that they are concerned about, and areas where they feel GAO work is warranted. And we spend time hearing their priorities. Then we develop our approaches to solving the problems or addressing the problems that they would like us to review. They will send us a letter that outlines the areas that they have identified for a review. We will then meet with those clients to get a better understanding of what their interests are. We will spend a good deal of time in internal discussions within the building, thinking about the methodologies that would best be used. What data sources might be available? Who do we need to talk to? What documents might be available? Then we will formulate questions that we think can drive our research efforts. We will make sure that the congressional clients are comfortable with those questions. Then we will engage with the executive branch. We will first send over an announcement letter telling the agency involved that we plan to do this work. We will then set up an entrance conference with the relevant officials at the executive agency to explain what our audit objectives are, to identify who at the executive agency we need to be dealing with, to identify the data sources that they have that might be useful to us in answering and addressing our research objectives, identifying the documents that we think we're going to require, to get all those logistics issues covered in the initial meeting as best we can. Then we begin the nuts and bolts of auditing, of analyzing data, identifying documents and reviewing documents, interviewing agency officials, collecting all sorts of information that we think is relevant to addressing the questions that we've been asked to address. We then spend time analyzing all of that information, developing a message that we think emanates from all of that information. What do we have here? Do we have findings? Do we have deficiencies? Are things going well? And if so, maybe there's areas for improvement. We consider all of those issues, and we develop from that a message that we think is really at the heart of an audit report. We then spend whatever time is needed to write that audit report. Sometimes that can be a matter of weeks, sometimes a matter of months, depending on the complexity and the amount of data that we've been reviewing. We then provide a draft of that report to the executive agency for their official comment and review. Very often we will conduct briefings with the executive agency to explain our findings. At the time that we provide the report to the executive agency, we will also offer it to our congressional clients for their review at the same time. Then we get official comments from the executive agency. We review those comments, particularly if there's recommendations that they either agree with or disagree with, and we will address those comments in a section of our report and issue the final report. Those reports are available on our website, which is www.gao.gov.
Do you have a sense, like, with regard to your recommendations that you make, how often do agencies or departments agree with them, not agree with them? If somebody disagrees violently, do you keep going back and forth to try to find a middle ground? Or do you just say, okay, that you disagree, you can put your comments at the end of the report and, like, just your standard format. How does that work? If you got something where somebody really is concerned about, what you found?
All of what you just listed are possibilities. First of all, our guiding principle is we want to have recommendations that are going to improve government programs. We're not simply trying to have recommendations for the sake of recommendations. We want to make sure that we understand the program and how it operates, and that we have identified an area or areas that can help to improve those programs. Our hope is that the executive agencies will agree with that. And most of the time, they do. Well over 50% of the time, federal agencies will agree with the recommendations. Doesn't happen all the time, of course. There are many instances where we stand our ground in face of an agency that disagrees with a recommendation. We will continue to reinforce that through regular follow-up to check back with them on a semi-annual or annual basis to determine whether there's been any progress in implementing the recommendation. At some point, we may have to simply drop it, but we don't do that lightly.
Right.
We maintain a focus on our recommendations for a period of 3 to 5 years to see if we can have any influence in getting the executive agency to see the light and make the changes that we think are needed.
Right, sort of like the high-risk list in government-wide contract, interagency contracting, doing some reports and following up on that and that sort of thing.
That's exactly right. We stay on it.
Yeah. So you've done the report. You've submitted to the agency. It's finalized. When you submit it to the Hill, does that often lead to actions either whether, we need to address it from a statutory perspective or an appropriation perspective? How does that play into, the translation of oversight or analysis that you provide for your congressional clients to congressional action?
We see congressional action in a number of instances. The primary way is when we identify programs that may be overfunded. They have too aggressive a schedule in producing a program. They can't use all of the available appropriated funds. We may make recommendations to slow down the funding, and we will see Congress take action on that. They may rescind appropriations that they have provided in the past. They may decline to provide additional appropriations. In some cases, they may cancel programs that our work has demonstrated are not functioning as they should.
Right. And or they can even, they may have hold a hearing and talk about the results of the report, and that in turn, helps, I guess the agency or department respond and adjust based on your recommendations. I assume that happens, right?
Those hearings are very important. GAO testifies over 100 times a year before various committees of the Congress. Those hearings are often based on published GAO work, but often, even if we don't have a recently published report, we have experience in the area, and committees often use us to set the stage, give us background, GAO, on where this program or this agency has been in the past as the committee conducts its own oversight of the executive agency.
Right. And right now, I have to respond to my oversight and have our next break there, Bill. So my guest today is Bill Woods. He is the director of the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. And when we come back, we're going to talk about his team, the Acquisition Sourcing Management Team, and their role and what they do and some of the very interesting work that they've done over the past year. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf. Today, my guest is Bill Woods. Bill is the Director of the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, otherwise known as GAO. And Bill, when we took the break, I had mentioned that we're going to talk about your team in particular, your area of focus as a leader of the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team. So I'm going to just turn it over to you if you want to talk about that. I think there's something else you wanted added about GAO more generally. We can hit that first and then talk about what you guys are up to in your particular office. So go ahead, Bill.
Sure. Well, let me start with GAO generally. We have about 3,000 people that work for the Government Accountability Office. Most of those people, about 2,000, work here in Washington, but about 1,000 or so work in various field offices across the country. We have a presence in most major cities, field offices of about 100 or 150 people that do the work seamlessly across GAO. They spend whatever time is needed in Washington, but they also help us have a nationwide presence so that when we are reviewing programs, very often we're right there in the localities where programs are being executed. So that nationwide presence gives us the flexibility to be able to have that ability to review programs where they're being carried out. Our team, for example, has a field office on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. We have about 30 or 40 people there that review largely aircraft programs, but other issues as well. So those 3,000 people are divided up into various teams by issue areas. We have teams that look at environmental issues, healthcare issues, defense management issues, energy, you name it, whatever issue the Congress might be concerned about, we will have a GAO team with the expertise that can address those issues. My particular team is the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team. That team consists of about 150 people, analysts that have been there in some cases for 30 or more years like myself, or in some cases have just started. But we provide the training that is needed in whatever area analysts might look at. And that training is a very, very important part of how GAO works. We want to make sure that people have the skills and ability, not only when they come in, but as they progress throughout their careers. And that focus on training, that focus on people, is one thing that has helped us maintain our status as one of the best places to work. We are always number two or number three.
Right. Yep, you're absolutely right. Yep.
On the list of best places to work for mid-size agencies. We're very proud of that, and we think it's because we focus on our people. Right. We want to make sure that our people have an experience where they just love coming to work every day. I've been there for a long period of time. And you love coming to work every day.
You would still be there, right?
I don't like getting to work.
Right.
Believe me, that part is not very pleasant.
None of us do around here.
Right. But once I'm there, the issues and the people are very, very satisfying. It's a great environment to work with. And enough of that ad. But let me turn now to the substance of the work that our team does. Because of the large amount of spending that goes on at the Department of Defense, we devote a significant amount of resources looking at the execution of weapon systems programs. The large aircraft programs, the naval vessels, aircraft carrier, or the littoral combat ship, these large programs are very, very important to the Congress, and therefore we devote a significant amount of resources to determining how well those programs are being executed, ranging from development of the requirements for these major systems to the funding and staffing and execution to the testing and evaluation to the deployment areas. We are constantly reviewing the execution of these large federal programs. We often find there's areas for improvement, frankly. These are large programs, not easy to execute, and we are always finding areas where these programs could be improved. Sometimes the agencies will agree with us, sometimes not, but the oversight is very important. So there's major weapons systems. There's also a large amount of our focus is on satellites, either NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration satellites and their programs, or the National Oceanographic Administration, their satellite programs. Again, that's another high-dollar area where we focus our work. Another example is missile defense. There's perhaps $10 billion a year spent on missile defense programs. A lot of money, a lot of our focus is therefore spent there. And another area I would mention would be the Department of Homeland Security that is quickly becoming a large agency with significant spending in the procurement area, and that puts our attention on that agency as well.
So, Bill, just in general, are there some interesting areas you've looked at in the last year that you can talk about that, you know, especially in the DOD realm that, to your point, it's like when you're talking, I'm thinking about just how much things cost to build and how complex they are, and just are there better ways to do it, or are there opportunities for improvement, and are there things that are working well, and just, you know, to the extent you've been looking at stuff over the past year, so it's more recent vintage, are there areas that, you know, you can talk about with regard to DOD?
Sure. Our colleagues have identified a number of major programs that are in need of improvement. The one that comes most readily to mind is the shipbuilding area, where enormous amounts of money are being spent on recapitalizing the Navy's fleet. And there are plenty of opportunities for savings, and we've issued reports that have identified those areas. But there's other areas as well that require attention. Not necessarily the large dollars that these major systems involve, but I spend a lot of my time working on areas like the General Services Administration and their schedule program. Each individual buy may be lower dollar value than some of these major programs, but still significant amounts of money in the hundreds of millions of dollars of task orders and delivery orders under the General Services Administration schedule program. So that, too, is an area where we've devoted a significant amount of resources. We issued a report last year that looked at the process for issuing task orders under the General Services Administration Federal Supply Program. And we found a couple of things. One is that the program is fortunately largely very competitive. 75% of the orders reviewed were competitive orders. And that's a significant number because when you're dealing in an area of commercial items, the expectation is that there would be
competition,
a substantial amount of competition. So we were pleased with that. We did find, however, that there was insufficient focus on the pricing. And let me tell you exactly what we mean by that. There is a requirement in the Federal Acquisition Regulation that when agencies issue orders under the GSA's program, that they are required to seek additional discounts from the schedule vendors. And we found that in a number of the orders that we looked at, that agencies were not seeking those additional discounts. And that's unfortunate because when they did seek discounts, they obtained them, sometimes very large amounts. In one case, there was an order in the millions of dollars where the agency received a 50% discount. That's a significant savings. And so we made a recommendation that the agencies that we reviewed, make a renewed focus on the requirement to seek discounts off the GSA schedule.
Well, right now I have to take our next break, Bill. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Bill Woods. He is the director of the Acquisition Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government and Accountability Office. And we'll continue that discussion of the GSA Schedules program a little bit and talk about that report and some of the findings. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Bill Woods. He's the director of the Acquisition Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO. I think this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about a report on defense pricing or analysis of pricing and negotiation price or data request related to price commercial pricing. It was interesting, the GAO report that was issued on the schedules that we talked about in the last segment, it sounds to me like, by and large, and this is my perspective, you don't have to agree or not, Bill, but it sounds like the schedules are working as they're intended and to a large extent. To the extent they have 75% of the orders are competitive, that's, I think, better than most contract vehicles or even open market buys overall. At least that's what I recall. And at the same time, the fact that you can get a big discount that you mentioned for a multimillion dollar task order competition, like 50%, that makes a lot of sense to me because it's a firm commitment to buy at that point in time. And, that's what competition and access to the commercial market is all about. And that's my little soapbox for a moment, Bill. But, the pricing report, the DOD pricing report and request for data for purposes of trying to determine prices fair and reasonable was an interesting report. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, Roger. As you know, in the area of commercial items, there are limits on the types of data and the amount of data that contracting officers can request from the vendors in establishing the reasonableness of prices. And one of the concerns that industry has had, that vendors have had over the years, is that some contracting officers are overstepping those limits and are asking for and indeed requiring more information from vendors than the law and the regulation permits. So we were asked to review the pricing and the price reasonableness determinations for commercial items. We wanted to get a very, very close and deep view of how things actually operate in practice. So we selected a limited sample where we could drill down and take a deep dive, if you will, into how these contracts were priced. And in most of the cases that we reviewed, the contracting officer did not request cost data from the vendors. They were able to determine that the prices were fair and reasonable based on existing information, historical prices or publicly available catalogs, prices that they paid last year or that other entities paid, that sort of thing, without turning to requesting information from the vendor. But in some of those cases, in fact, 12, in six of the cases, the contracting officers requested pricing type information from the vendors. What prices have you, Mr. Vendor, sold these items on the commercial market, and give us the support for that? In six other cases, they also requested, in addition to pricing information, they requested cost information. And the cost information is the type of information that really causes lots of problems for vendors, because their position is, we don't provide that type of information when we sell in the commercial marketplace. And when you, the government, enter into the commercial marketplace to buy commercial items, you shouldn't be asking for cost information either. But we did find that in six instances, there were requests made for cost type information. The other thing that we were struck with is the complexity of these negotiations. these were very, very complex buys, often for hundreds of commercial items, but they were airline parts for fighters.
Right,
or
so they were commercial items that were going into government unique sort of products, right?
Exactly. Right. Commercial items going into government unique mainframes and platforms. And we did find that they were requesting cost information. We also found that the determination itself as to whether the item was commercial or not was extraordinarily difficult and often took months and in one case years to resolve about whether an item was commercial or not. Seems to us that we've got to find a better way to deal with that because the customer who needs the parts, they pay the price. They're not getting the parts in the time frames that they need them.
Right. And just for the audience, the issue of whether it's a commercial item or not goes to the type of information you can request and get from a prospective contractor, correct? That's why that's such a big deal?
It is a big deal because, as you point out, when an item is determined to be commercial, that limits the amount of information that the contracting officer can request.
Right. And in the instances, the six, there were six where they asked for pricing information, like how much others had paid for the same item or similar items, I assume, was asked for, and the versus the cost information that was requested in the other examples. What was the company's response? Did they give all the information in the pricing instance or not? And in the cost instance, did they balk or how did it work out?
It varied, but as a general matter, obtaining the pricing information was easier for the contracting officers. When they stepped over and requested cost information, for example, how many man hours did it take to produce this item? What were your material costs? That sort of thing. What was your the overhead and the breakdown of the overhead that went into pricing this item? Those kinds of more sensitive types
Those are like really proprietary information. I would argue even what others have paid is proprietary in a sense because that's your sort of what your market is and what people are willing to pay for your product, and you want to know that versus others. But that might be a bit more public. But I think where you're going to your point is that is very sensitive information, like the cost buildup for a particular product, right? I mean, I think what one of the biggest issues companies have.
That's exactly right. All of these companies consider that type of information to be very, very sensitive, and things that they would not disclose on a regular basis to their commercial company customers, and they feel should not have to be disclosed to the government either.
Right. So you mentioned there's got to be a better way. Did the report make any recommendations of that or just ideas to be pursued or fleshed out?
That report did not make recommendations, but we did point out at the conclusions that this is a very, very complex area. It's one that the Congress has recently legislated
NDAA,
on in the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2016. There were a number of provisions that directed the executive branch to take a different approach to provide additional guidance on what types of information can be obtained from vendors in acquiring commercial items.
Right. And it's on that dynamic of the NDAA and then the proposed rule and your report all coming out. It was quite interesting. The DOD's proposed rule, for commercial item pricing. That's kind of like, it was an interesting fall, I would say. Would you say that?
There were a lot of issues at play, both on the executive side and the congressional side. I think that debate is not over, frankly. I think we're going to see more in the next legislative cycle. The Department of Defense withdrew their rule, some hint that that debate is not over and that they may come back with additional rulemaking at some point in the future.
Right. Well, it's been, and I'm sure your office will be, whatever's implemented, you'll be at some point down the road, you know, maybe in year 40 of your career, taking a look at how it's been implemented and what's the impact been, right?
I think so. This is an important area.
Absolutely.
The market is moving in a direction where the federal government is no longer the principal driver in a lot of these areas. And the consensus seems to be that the government needs to get on board with the way that the commercial market behaves, both in terms of pricing as well as other elements of the transaction, and that the days when the government could dictate the terms of transactions when it enters into the commercial market, those days are over.
Yeah. And on that note, I want to thank my guest today is Bill Woods. Bill is the director of the Acquisition and Sourcing Management Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.